You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of February 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. We're live from Studio One here in Marylebone, central London. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be asking what Ireland's referendum on the EU fiscal treaty could mean for the future of the euro. We'll also be checking in with our culture editor, Robert Bound, in New York. And we'll be asking what a future without fiscal money could look like and whether Comedy Central can make it in Russia. And we'll also hear about the German town being transformed by anonymous philanthropy. All that, plus a quick glance at the front pages Australia and New Zealand are waking up to, and a decent song or two. Right here on Midori House, live on Monocle 24. But before all that, here's Nick Kelly with the latest world headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. North Korea has agreed to stop nuclear tests, uranium enrichment and long-range missile launches, and to allow nuclear inspectors to visit its Yongbyon nuclear complex to verify the moratorium has been enforced. The announcement, made simultaneously by the US State Department and North Korea's official news agency, paves the way for the possible resumption of six-party disarmament negotiations with Pyongyang and follows talks between US and North Korean diplomats in Beijing last week. It also marks a significant policy shift by North Korea's reclusive leadership following the death in December of veteran leader Kim Jong-il. US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that North Korea's nuclear moratorium is a step on the path of peace.
Today's announcement represents a modest first step in the right direction. We, of course, will be watching closely and judging North Korea's new leaders by their actions.
The International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, said the situation in Homs is extremely tense as Syrian troops launched a ground attack on the city today in an apparent attempt to overrun the rebel-held Babu Amru neighbourhood that has endured 25 days of siege and fierce bombardment. ICRC spokesman Hashim Hassan, speaking in Geneva, outlined the situation.
Even though we have managed to bring in food assistance to Homs but also to Idlib, sadly, the Syrian Red Crescent volunteers have not been able to distribute anything yet due to the very difficult security condition, although this is very important and crucial to happen as soon as possible.
UN humanitarian aid chief Valerie Amos said today she was deeply disappointed that Syria has refused to allow her to visit the country, where she had hoped to assess the need for emergency relief. Libya will donate $100 million in humanitarian aid to the Syrian opposition and allow them to open an office in Tripoli, a government spokesman said, in a further sign of its strong support for forces fighting President Assad. The UN has confirmed that the number of people killed since Syrian security forces launched a crackdown on dissent last March has passed 7,500. Egypt's presidential election will be held over 2 days, starting May the 23rd, the State Election Committee said today, as the country's military rulers prepare to hand power to civilians after last year's overthrow of Hosni Mubarak. A runoff vote will take place on June the 16th and 17th, and final results will be released on June the 21st. A former CIA ghost prisoner who grew up in the Baltimore area of the United States has admitted to a US war crimes court that he was an Al-Qaeda money courier and martyr in training, now prepared to help prosecute other terrorism suspects. After nearly 9 years in US custody, Pakistani native Majid Khan appeared in public for the first time at a top security courtroom on the Guantanamo Bay US naval base in Cuba. He pleaded guilty to all 5 charges against him, including murder and attempted murder, in a deal that spares him from a potential life sentence in exchange for helping prosecute other prisoners. Security plans have been put in place for the London Olympic Games to make sure the United Kingdom is prepared in every respect to deal with any threats. The British Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, said the potential of any outside threat or danger at this summer's Games was hopefully very unlikely, but said a huge operation was ready to deal with anything that might go wrong.
Well, what we're primarily about is making sure that there is a safe and secure Olympic Games so people can come to London and enjoy themselves, secure in the knowledge that they are being properly protected.
Finally, German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble was criticised today for playing Sudoku on a small computer during a crucial parliamentary debate on Greece, becoming a lightning rod for the growing opposition in Germany to the latest bailout. His spokesman defended Schäuble against charges of arrogance for playing the numbers puzzle while on the government bench during the debate, saying he had worked tirelessly for 10 straight days on behalf of German interests. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
And when can't you play Sudoku? I mean, really, of all these things. I don't see a problem with that. If he's been working 10 days solidly and he wants to, you know...
It's when you get caught on cameras.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's necessarily sensible in terms of, you know, your politically speaking. But still, anyway. A very quick look at the front pages that people in Sydney, Melbourne, Auckland and elsewhere in Australasia are waking up to. The Age, transport needs billions. This is saying that public transport in Victoria has been dragged down by years of poor management and planning, needs an annual injection of $3 billion Australian dollars. The Sydney Morning Herald goes with, they've got a story on the right about Julia Gillard's attempt to appoint a new foreign minister. Bob Carr was a bit bungled. He said no. She denied that she even asked him. The Australian leads with that as well, and also has a comment piece by Dennis Shanahan on the front page that says Julia Gillard once more had put herself on the spot, proved publicly inept, failed the common sense test, and looked evasive. So good news all round for her. New Zealand Herald .com, my jail misery. This is Kim.com, the head of Mega Upload, has given his first interview to the New Zealand Herald. He says he will fight extradition to the United States. Of course, he would say that. Anyway, here is Thomas Schaffnacker with the World Weather Report.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And here's our look at Europe. Sunny weather across France, the Alps, Spain and Italy. A taste of spring here with temperatures 15 to 20 degrees. However, in the UK, Benelux and Germany, still fairly cloudy, but from tomorrow, it's looking sunnier. Southeast Europe, so the Balkans, also Greece, cold with some rain, and Far Eastern Europe still around zero, so quite a mix of weather across the continent as we end February. The city forecast for the 1st of March then, Thursday, London, 12 degrees, partly cloudy. In Lyon, 17 Celsius with sunshine. In Milan, 16 degrees, also some sun here, but in Kiev, it's zero with some light snow. North America now, and some appalling weather hitting the upper Midwest of the United States, including many of the cities around the Great Lakes region. Snow, ice and heavy rain causing travel problems. The bad weather is on its way to the Atlantic coast, and it'll turn snowy in New England and upstate New York. However, end of the week, better weather everywhere. On to Thursday's city outlook. In Montreal, minus 2 degrees with snow. New York, 5 degrees with rain. Chicago, 8 Celsius, partly cloudy. And in San Francisco, 12 degrees with showers. On to other world locations. In South America, Buenos Aires, after midweek thunderstorms, the second half of the week is sunny, 28 here. Sao Paulo, hot through Friday, 32 degrees. And in Australia, New South Wales, suffering from frequent heavy thunderstorms. So if you're off to Sydney, a high chance of getting wet, 25 in Sydney. That's all. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffnacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schaffnacker. It is 18:08 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e Yorkosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, and we are live on Monocle 24. Now, Ireland was among the 25 European Union states which agreed to stricter budget discipline last month in Brussels in order to try and safeguard against further debt problems in the Eurozone. At the time, it was the UK and Czech Republic who were in the spotlight for refusing to sign up to the treaty. But now the Irish government has announced it will have to hold a national referendum in order to go ahead with the plans, with no certainty, of course, that the results will be what the rest of the Eurozone is hoping for. Joining me on the line now to explore this further is Dr. Owen O'Malley, a lecturer in political science at the School of Law and Government at Dublin City University. Dr. O'Malley, thank you very much for joining us today. How likely is it that Ireland will vote no?
Well, to be honest, it's very tight. Nobody really knows because the campaign hasn't started yet. But if we are to go by the last number of EU referendums that Ireland has had, we tend to have one or two every couple of years. They have been defeated. Two of them, the Lisbon Treaty was initially defeated, and the Nice Treaty were both initially defeated. So, and there is also growing scepticism about Europe and the European Union. There's a bit of antipathy, not to the extent there is in Greece, but there's a bit of antipathy towards Germany, especially, and the EU generally. And trust in the EU has gone down a lot.
And if it is a no vote, what does that mean for Ireland's membership of the Euro and indeed the European Union?
Well, it probably means more for Ireland than it does for the other countries. Unlike the other EU referendums, this isn't strictly part of the EU architecture. So what it means for Ireland will be that we'll be just a bad boy in Europe, but it won't have any legal implications for our membership of the European Union or our membership of the Euro. We can still do that, but it'll mean within the Euro we aren't going to be at the table where they discuss fiscal policy and things like that. So we'd be withdrawing ourselves from any kind of policy-making framework there.
And in terms of the time frame, I mean, there's some talk that it might take, you know, maybe three months perhaps for the vote to take place. Potentially, what could that do in terms of, you know, because I mean, when we're talking about these bailouts and making these changes, you know, things have to be done relatively quickly. Are there worries that this might stall the process?
Well, the way it works for this so-called fiscal compact. So this agreement only has to be agreed by 12 of the 17 Eurozone countries, and they can go ahead once they've agreed that. So Ireland isn't going to be able to stall it in the same way that it could before. So in other EU referendums or in EU referendums or treaty changes, they had to go at the pace of the slowest man, and Ireland was invariably the slowest man. We had to legally have to have a referendum on constitutional changes. And so when Ireland voters said no, this kind of caused panic in Europe, and so we had visits from Sarkozy, who tried to charm us and then got angry with us.
He tried the charm, and then when that didn't work, got angry.
Yeah, he came over on a visit when he was kind of kissing everybody and smiling. The Irish didn't really react as he had wanted, and then started kind of throwing angry statements about the Irish from the Elysee Palace about how they were kind of laggards and not quite proper Europeans.
Excellent.
And so that didn't do his image much good here, but not that he cares.
No, probably not. Well, in terms of, you said obviously there was a referendum over the Nice Treaty, over Lisbon. There's a referendum every time there's a major decision. How do most people in Ireland feel about that? I mean, are they quite happy that they have this power themselves? They haven't simply left it in the hands of their politicians, of their elected representatives?
Yeah, the people are delighted about it. The politicians aren't quite so happy. So I suppose the elites think that a lot of these decisions aren't things that should be left to ordinary people because ordinary people don't understand it. And that's probably true for a lot of the treaties, like the Lisbon Treaty was, 1,000 pages long, and nobody read it, including the Prime Minister of the country admitted that he hadn't read it, but did ask us to vote for it, where this one is just about 11 or so pages long, so more people will read it. But generally the Irish are very happy that they are the only ones that they can get to choose on this, and if anybody tried to take that away from them, I think you would see kind of quite a bit of backlash.
I mean, there is an argument, though, that if you want a sort of a fairly sort of strong decision-making body that has 27 members in it, then you can't go back and have referendums or referenda in every single one of those 27 countries every time a major a decision comes up. That way surely lies madness.
Yeah, that would be the case if we're not... it's not every time there's a major decision. So if the EU decides to impose sanctions on Iran, it's not like the Irish people have.
No, sure. But every time there's a new treaty or something, major changes.
Yeah, but I suppose every time there's a constitutional change, I mean, you might say it seems a bit ridiculous that you have this political organisation that doesn't have a constitution that can last more than 2 years or more until the next crisis. So every time there's a crisis, they feel the need to change the constitution. And it might be better, rather than having these 1,000-page treaties, to have a pretty short constitution, 30 or 40 pages long, that people can read and understand, everybody in Europe might accept, and that's loose enough that you don't have to go back and change the constitution every time you have come across a new problem.
That sounds like slightly wishful thinking, though, to be honest, doesn't it?
Well, wishful thinking, I mean, maybe it's wishful thinking to expect a country or a federation such as the European Union sort of is to just have rules that can stay the same regardless of the political crisis or economic crisis that it's facing.
Well, indeed. Dr. O'Malley, thank you very much for joining me. We're going to have a song now. This is A Fine Frenzy with Happier. That was A Fine Frenzy with Happier. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. I'll be back after this short break to get some cultural highlights from Robert Bound in New York.
With bureaus in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York and Zurich, and over 25 correspondents around the world, Monocle has an experienced team of editors and journalists filing for us around the clock. From our bureau in Tokyo, Kenji Hall covers Japan and beyond.
I've kicked the tires of the Taiwanese president's motorcade, and in the span of just a couple of weeks, I've swung through more than a dozen cities across Japan, from Hiroshima to Sapporo, for Monocle's Japan Guide. The best part, though, is that I get to live in Tokyo. There's really no better city to get lost in and to mingle with world-class architects, artists, and artisans. It's a city where food and fashion are a religion, where designers like Naoto Fukasawa turn everyday products into art.
That was Monocle's Kenji Hall, our man in Tokyo.
You're listening to Monocle 24. Join us at 2200 hours London time and end the day with the Monocle Daily, live every weekday.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Wednesday is Culture Day on Midori House. Normally, Robert Bound would be here in the studio with me talking about all things cultural, but he can't be here in the studio today because for some reason we've let him fly off to New York. But he is in our New York bureau, aren't you, Rob?
I am. I feel like I'm kind of like winning an award and I couldn't make it, but I'm coming to you live via satellite from Beverly Hills. Except I'm not. I'm coming to you from the Monocle bureau on Broadway.
Indeed, and there is no award, I'm afraid. Sorry.
There's no award?
That. No, sorry.
Oh, man, well, if I'd known, I wouldn't have dialed up the ISDN line, Steve, if I'd known.
But sorry, there was nothing did we tempt you with an award? Okay.
I was told there'd be prizes.
We're always told there's prizes. There never are. How's New York treating you?
New York's been amazing. It's been super fun. It has, and this is not necessarily a euphemism for anything, Steve, it's been quite tiring.
Really, has it?
So, tiring and emotional. And we had our fifth birthday party for the magazine last night, which was great. We had a bash at the British consul's residence up in sort of 51st Street, and then we had our after party, which went on a bit. You'd be proud
Excellent.
Of us.
Oh, good, good. Proud and maybe slightly jealous as well.
Oh, sorry.
That's
Your
quite
time
right.
will come, I hear, in San Francisco.
Yes, indeed. And now I understand, as well as getting tired and emotional at parties with Brits, you're going to be heading off to a restaurant that has its own radio station.
Yeah, I'm hoping to sort this out tomorrow, actually. This is Heritage Radio, which is part of, sort of allied to Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick in Brooklyn. And it's a Yeah, it's a restaurant that has a radio station called Heritage Radio. People like the idea of heritage, don't they? There's a lot of heritage...
They do.
It's a sort of prefix that comes with a lot of food on American menus or New York menus. So that's what that's all about. We shall see how you can sustain an entire radio station all about food. Would you be able to do it, Steve?
I'm not entirely sure I could. I mean, we've got, you know, we have an hour-long food and drink show, you know, Monocle 24, which is, I'm fairly sure we could stretch that a little bit.
Yeah, but only 23 hours to go, chaps.
Exactly. I mean, you know, how much is there really to say about food over 24 hours? Well, you will be able to fill us in on all of that when you've been.
I hope it'll make a neat audio package for the Culture Show. That's what we've been promised.
Oh, really?
I hope I can deliver.
Okay, yeah, well, so. I will tune into the Culture Show with who's the man who does it? Anyway, I'll tune into that on Monday at 1900 hours at GMT.
Do it. Exactly.
Now, one of the great things about going to New York is you get to go to New York record shops.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that you've spent, you know, many of your hours during the day wandering the streets of Soho and elsewhere.
I have. I've been flipping my fingers through some racks. I hope that doesn't sound as bad as it sort of almost sounded, Steve.
Yeah, almost.
Down at other music. I was speaking, in fact, with our friend Andrew Mueller about Rebel and other music the other night, and I picked up a sort of bag of goodies, which we're going to hear something of, I think, at the end of our chat, aren't we?
We're
going to segue neatly into a song. And also, there's a couple of other things we're going to try and squeeze in tomorrow. Cindy Sherman has a sort of landmark survey show at MoMA. It's a big sort of New York art moment, I think, like a proper sort of member of New York art royalty at the MoMA, and it's a survey show, so it's sort of one of those sort of halfway through your career. Let's have a look and see how you've done, Cindy.
Let's look at what you've won so far.
Here's what you could have won. So that's good. And we swung past the new museum on the Bowery the other day. And I'm slightly sad to see that it's lost its Hell Yes. It's famous for having this big Hell Yes sign on it. And that's
and it's gone.
Swapped temporarily for this rose by an artist called Isa Getzkin.
But have they kept the Hell Yes? Are they going to put it back at some stage?
I hope it's coming back. I know, I felt like going in and asking them what happened to it. Or maybe it's been sold. I don't know what happened to it. It's the kind of thing I wouldn't mind, you know, if
they don't need it.
If was looking the other way, I'd get on a stepladder and take it down myself.
Well, in the days or hours you have left in New York, perhaps you could find out exactly what's happened to the Hell Yes sign.
I will. I'll fill you in.
And do so. Other Records is a place where you've been buying stuff. What have you been buying? And talk us through what the record store is like. Is it your sort of traditional sort of record shop? You know, all sort of everything laid out as you'd expect, or do they have any surprises?
Yeah, it's other music. Other music's a bit of a sort of Manhattan. Sort of record shop icon, I suppose, and it's one of these things that does that. It's got stacks of, I say, the normal stuff. I mean, I guess normal stuff, rock and indie, and is sort of probably its main stuff, and hip hop too, and a bit of jazz. But it does what, you know, lots of record shops sort of do, but maybe don't do as well as other music, which is they have these handwritten notes or sort of slightly typed, depending upon the. Presumably the handwriting quality of the person that's recommending the records.
If anyone's a doctor, then perhaps, you know, they get to type it up rather than have their scroll.
Yeah, exactly. If you write that with your left hand or your foot. And so it kind of trades off its recommendations. And they always have a newsletter as well that you can now get online, which is kind of quite good. There's some quite good writing, you know, that goes into this stuff. So it's kind of like a bit of criticism. We're big fans of kind of
quite good writing.
Curatorial eye, yeah, and having a kind of edit of what you should buy when it's a record shop.
Yeah,
and, you know, half the stock's vinyl, half the stock's CD. You need to be led through the stuff. It's not like it pretends to sell everything, but what it does, I guess, it is what you might call a neatly edited selection of cool stuff. So I sort of put a blindfold on and was led round and literally sort of picked up 10 CDs off some shelves. So
to see what you get.
If you absolutely hate the song that's coming up, Steve,
it wasn't your fault.
It's not my fault.
Okay, well, fair enough. It's not your fault. But what is it? What are we going to play?
This is from Sleigh Bells' new album. They're a Brooklyn band. We have to say, I wonder if anyone in Manhattan actually makes music. It seems to be compulsory to be from Brooklyn.
Do you think they might have originally been from Manhattan but thought, you know what, when we get signed, let's move to Brooklyn, it'll sound better.
Yeah, let's untuck our shirts. Right? They're Sleigh Bells, and I think this is from their second album. This is called the album's called Reign of Terror, and this track is End of the Line.
Brilliant. Rob, thank you very much. That was End of the Line by Sleigh Bells, and hopefully Rob will be bringing back the rest of that album, plus many others, when he returns from New York. In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be speaking with the author who's been exploring what money really means to us, and we'll be also finding out why Comedy Central is branching out into Russia. But first, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks, Steve. North Korea has agreed to stop nuclear tests, uranium enrichment and long-range missile launches, and to allow nuclear inspectors to visit its Yongbyon nuclear complex to verify the moratorium has been enforced. The International Committee of the Red Cross said the situation in Homs is extremely tense as Syrian troops launched a ground attack on the city today in an apparent attempt to overrun the rebel-held Baba Amru neighbourhood that has endured 25 days of siege and fierce bombardment. Egypt's presidential election will be held over 2 days starting May the 23rd as the country's military rulers prepare to hand power to civilians after last year's overthrow of Hosni Mubarak. A former CIA ghost prisoner who grew up in the US state of Baltimore has admitted to a US war crimes court that he was an Al-Qaeda money courier and martyr in training, now prepared to help prosecute other terrorism suspects. Attackers wielding knives have killed 13 people in China's Xinjiang region before police shot 7 of them dead in the latest violence to strike the ethnically divided northwestern area of China. The UN nuclear watchdog believes unspecified activities may be taking place at an Iranian military site, which may make its request to visit the Parchin facility more urgent. James Murdoch, the younger son of Rupert, will relinquish his position as executive chairman of News International in a statement by its parent company, News Corp. The US Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney has avoided a humiliating defeat in the state where he grew up as he edges rival Rick Santorum in a bitterly fought Michigan primary. And the former German president Christian Wolff will receive a pension of €199,000 a year for the rest of his life, despite resigning in disgrace after only 20 months in office. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, on Monocle 24. It is 18:33 here in London, 13:33 in New York. Now, the vision of a cashless society has long been touted as the future. First, it was credit cards, and now mobile technology make it increasingly easier to pay for things without actually dipping into your wallet. But is there a value, more than the obvious monetary kind, which we attach to those little metal discs and sheets of colourful paper? Well, that's what author David Wolman thought, and so he decided to explore what money really means to us in his new book, The End of Money: Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming Cashless Society. He joins me now on the line from Washington. Welcome, David. Now, any book these days sort of has to have a sort of personal journey, and yours was to actually live without using cash at all for a year. How hard actually was it to do that? It strikes me as actually being, you know, perhaps fairly easy these days.
You know, in fact, it was not that hard right up until I bumped into those moments when it was completely impossible. And
what are those impossible moments then?
Yeah, I'll illustrate a few of those in a second. I should say, interestingly enough, it was reading a story on a blog years ago about a guy in the UK who had lost a bet, I think, where someone had dared him or bet him to live cashlessly for a while that got me started on this idea. And in exploring sort of the place of money in our life, you know, this was a way for me to kind of keep the meditation going throughout my year of reporting and writing. And as I was saying, I didn't really get into a pickle that often, except, for example, one morning when I suddenly had to hop on a train from suburban New Jersey into what is arguably one of the financial centers of the universe, right into Manhattan. You cannot ride a New Jersey Transit train into Manhattan and pay for your ticket with anything but little strips of paper or little coins. You know, you can buy a ticket in advance or buy a monthly pass, et cetera. I had to hop on the train that morning, so I was in trouble there, and the conductor listen sympathetically to my my explanation.
I'm writing a book. I can't use money. I'm sure he's probably heard that one before.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me ask, in that situation, if you then get fined, can you pay the fine by credit card?
You probably can, because it's for a sum that I think, you know, most people now are used to paying with credit cards. And, you know, this is one of the peculiar contrasts that emerge in this reporting. To such a large extent, we have already pushed cash to the periphery of our everyday lives and our everyday financial lives, right? You know, people aren't paying the lion's share of people out there are not paying their mortgages and their car payments with big piles of cash, let alone buying a sofa or a meal. So cash is way out on the edges already. And yet, when you bring up the prospect of sort of a formal funeral arrangements for the technology that is cash, the very old-fashioned technology that is cash, people really go crazy. They go bananas, and they will tell you that you are subjecting our lives to the scrutiny of banks and credit card companies even more so. They tell me that I'm going to have to pry the cash from their cold, dead hands. They say that, you know, often, in a way that some people are opposed to e-books, actually, I found some similarity. Some people just say, you know, they didn't sound like zealots necessarily. They say, there's just something about the physical. There's something about the tactile. And that sentiment certainly resonates for me. And, of course, you know, we treat money, different forms of money, quite differently. And this is sort of the psychology section of the book. You know, why do we spend, you know, 50 pounds in paper money? It gets spent differently and is actually more difficult to spend or part with than 50 pounds equivalent sort of electronic money. And so that's sort of a peculiar behavioral economics piece of the puzzle.
And there's also, there's also sort of a symbolic thing about cash as well when we think about, you know, who is on our money, you know, whether, you know, here in the UK there's been a lot of discussion about, well, if we were to ditch the pound and join the euro, would the Queen still be on our money? You know, in the US there's discussions about, you know, some Republicans say, oh, Ronald Reagan should have his face on a banknote, but obviously Democrats are less keen on that. Is that part of our sort of connection to money, that it's sort of symbols of what, who we are and what our country is all about?
Absolutely. I mean, it's sort of one of the last literal touchstones of national identity, right? And, you know, some people are telling me that retiring the greenback or, you know, the U.S. dollar, this would be tantamount to, you know, burning the flag on the steps of the Capitol kind of sentiments. And, you know, for the chapter of the book where I explore this question of the relationship between the state and the national currency and the economy, I went to Iceland kind of to do a post-mortem on their financial collapse, but through the particular lens of cash. And, you know, at the time, this might sound just outrageous at the moment, but at the time they were sincerely talking about ditching the krona to get on the euro. And, you know, so I flew over there to meet with the woman who designed Iceland's banknotes to ask her these kinds of questions about the relationship between the state and money and the imagery embedded in it. And, you know, she had some real insights about this heritage you can hold in your hand, was her turn of phrase. And yet, of course, what happened to me while over there, and happens a lot when I'm sort of doing this travelogue-style writing, is while I'm visiting someplace far away, I'm reflecting quite a bit about life at home, and in this case, the U.S. dollar and its place in our lives, and, you know, for Americans and for people in the U.K. or anywhere, you know, the national currency it's part of the myth-making of the value of behind it, right? Because there is no intrinsic value to it. Paper money is just paper. It is only worth as much as we believe it's worth, et cetera, et cetera. But creating that sense, that illusion of stability and that illusion of real value is quite a tricky game. And, you know, the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve, they take this very seriously. And in the States, this is why there is such reluctance to any dramatic redesign of U.S. dollar bills, because then you're sort of the fear, the unspoken fear, is you're essentially reminding people of the fiction of money.
Indeed. Dave, one final thing. Were there any different cultures or countries you came across where actually, you know, you think that there could be a cashless society where people didn't have that connection with it, or, you know, it would have been quite easy to go around without actually, you know, dipping your hand into your wallet and taking out notes and coins?
I don't think we're going to be there tomorrow, but I think, you know, a country or a few countries that jump to mind as sort of leading the charge is certainly the countries of Scandinavia. You know, a place like Iceland is a nice example. They're already enamored by electronic money, and just thinking about, you know, stocking a cash register in some remote fishing village, let alone sort of securing that cash store and supplying, it just doesn't make any sense. And So people in those parts of the world definitely get it. In Japan, Korea, this is another area where, you know, people are, they're so quick to adopt new technologies over there. And so I think they're pushing the envelope. However, while doing some reporting on counterfeiting and anti-counterfeiting technologies, it was so interesting to learn in Japan about a number of the ways that cash is still used in culture. You know, even though everyone's using electronic money for most things, you know, when you're giving someone a wedding gift or a New Year's gift, you have to give them banknotes, crisp new banknotes. And even as condolence, when there's a death in the family, you're supposed to give banknotes. And so there are these ways that culture is kind of, that cash is embedded in our cultures that, you know, arguably...
David, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there, but thank you. David Wellman, thank you very much. The book is The End of Money. If you're going to buy it, dip into your pocket and use a banknote. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're back with some more music after this.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cosy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
A survey of the global newsstand, some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest, and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It is 1842. And earlier today, we heard that Davy Jones from the Monkees has died. So, in memory of him, here is I'm a Believer by the Monkees. It's a solid thing. That was The Monkees with I'm a Believer. We're going to be talking about Russia and comedy in a moment. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. Russians turning on their TV sets in the coming months may be in for a funny surprise. Viacom have announced that they will be launching a 100% Russian language version of Comedy Central there in April, under the name Paramount Comedy. American favourites available to Russian viewers will be South Park and Last Man Standing, and Russian comedians such as Dmitry Romano will also reportedly play a key role in the new channel. But how confined is comedy in Russia, and will Paramount be able to nail the Russian sense of humour? Joining us now in the studio to explore this further is Monocle contributor Andrew Osborne, who's just returned to London after living in Moscow for many years. Welcome to Midori House, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Your first time here in the studios.
Indeed it is, and I'm glad to be here.
Rather than in Moscow.
Absolutely. Well, it's much colder, yes.
It is. Yeah, that is true. It is much, much colder there. So, despite the fact that you've left, I mean, it does mean you're going to miss out on ever watching Paramount Comedy. Do you think you're going to be missing out? How good is comedy Russian style?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's true that traditionally Russia has not been an amazingly famous venue for comedy, of course. I mean, I think people would struggle to name many famous Russian comedians. And I don't think that's just because of the linguistic barrier. You know, obviously, we do associate, it is, of course, a stereotype, but we do associate Russians with being a little dour, at least in public, and not exactly, kind of reveling in comedy. So, it is unusual, but I think it will be interesting, and I think it does really represent a change. It shows that Russian society is changing. Russian society is perhaps beginning to open up 20 years after the fall of the Soviet Union. Personally, I'm not going to be gutted to be missing this. Perhaps it will be broadcast on the internet. Who knows? But I'm sure there is a big appetite in Russia for this. And I'm sure the people behind this must have looked into that and realised that there is.
Well, yes, you know, one assumes that they're doing this because they think there's obviously a market for it. I mean, has the comedy scene in Russia developed much over the last decade or so? Did you, you know, the time you were there, did you notice it changing at all?
I did, yes. It has changed massively in the last, I'd say, 5 years, certainly. There has really been an explosion in the popularity of comedy, particularly of televised stand-up comedy in Russia. All of the mainstream channels have shows. The comics themselves, there are about half a dozen of them, have become household names across Russia, and they've become fabulously wealthy as well. They've become huge celebrities. So it's a real phenomenon, and something really quite new for Russia, quite extraordinary. So I think, obviously, the producers, or the people behind, rather, this new localised version of Comedy Central are hoping to tap into that.
Now, two of the, you know, the most popular and most famous internationally shows on Comedy Central are The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and also The Colbert Report with Stephen Colbert. Now, they're not going to be on in Russia. But do you think that there's the potential at the moment, you know, looking at the political situation as it is, for some form of Russian version of, say, The Daily Show?
You know, I think there is a version, and indeed people, or there is rather a potential for such a version. In recent years, people have tried to imitate that. But clearly, Russia is not the United States. Russia is a de facto one-party state. There are very tight restrictions on freedom of expression, not least on television. In fact, more than any other medium, on television. So comedians do have to tread a very fine line when they are making jokes or about politicians or engaging in political satire, especially, of course, Vladimir Putin, the Prime Minister, who we expect soon to become president once again. So what I've noticed, certainly from living there is and watching these shows, the existing shows, is that, frankly, the jokes about politicians are super, super tame. Much, much tamer than you would see in the West. And indeed, when people have crossed a line on occasion, shows have been shut down. There was, for example, a few years ago, a show in Russia called, or translated into English, called The Puppets, which, if you like, was an imitation of a British political satire show called Spitting Image. Mm. That very quickly fell foul of the Kremlin, and they simply took it off air. So I think the creators of this new channel, anyone who is hoping to engage in political satire, is going to have to be quite careful if they want to stay on air.
And since we have you here, let's talk briefly about the elections on the 4th of March. As you say, you know, Putin is almost certain to be elected as president. Have you been surprised at the level of public protests over the past 2 or 3 months and what that might say about how Russia is changing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, to be honest, I was surprised, have been surprised by the scale of those protests. I think a lot of people have. I think a lot of analysts have, because there was this traditional view, again, a rather stereotypical view, perhaps, of Russians being rather apathetic when it came to politics. You know, it would be overstating the case to say that we have some kind of Slavic Arab Spring on our hands. We clearly don't. But nevertheless, this is pretty extraordinary, unprecedented in the numbers, tens of thousands of people taking to the streets of Moscow. You know, these are the biggest demonstrations of their kind since 91, since the fall of the Soviet Union. So, no, I mean, they're not going to topple Mr. Putin and, you know, his associates, but they have certainly really rattled their cage. I think that Mr. Putin and others, you know, will come increasingly under pressure to make concessions, to become more liberal. I think the big question is not really if that will happen. It clearly will happen. The question really is over what period of time that will happen. And it could be, it might be a slow and gradual process, unfortunately.
Now, these protests have been essentially anti-Putin rather than pro anyone else. Is there anyone else coming through who, you know, some of the protesters are starting to coalesce around, who maybe aren't standing in the presidential elections now, but could become interesting opposition figures in the years to come?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, traditionally, that has been the Achilles heel of the opposition in Russia. Frankly, they've not done a very good job at uniting amongst themselves. They've always squabbled amongst themselves. That is continuing right now. it's hard to say that right now, you know, 2012, February, that there is one person who they will coalesce around. However, there is one character who is beginning to emerge. He's a very famous, at least in Russia, famous blogger, Alexei Navalny is his name, famous anti-corruption blogger. He's scored many successes in that field. He seems to be, I mean, according to polls of opposition supporters, he seems to be the crowd's favourite. However, there is a problem with him, and that is certainly with, or for some liberal Russian opposition politicians, and that is that he is very strongly nationalist and has associated himself with rather unsavoury elements of the Russian nationalist wing. So, unfortunately for the Russian opposition, the situation is not clear-cut, and it may be some time before somebody emerges who really can unite all these actually very disparate kind of factions at the moment.
Andrew Osborne, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. We're back right after this.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 Tag, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24
is Monocle
24.
The Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
After Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, it's normally the kind of story that's confined to fairy tales. An anonymous benefactor leaves blank envelopes full of cash to help various people in need. But for residents of Braunschweig in Germany, it's not fictional. A nameless philanthropist has been leaving €10,000 donations at numerous locations around the city, from soup kitchens to daycare centres, churches and even the local paper. Joining us on the line from Braunschweig to explain this further is Henning Noske, local editor of Braunschweiger Zeitung. Welcome, Henning. Are you one of the recipients of this anonymous largesse?
Hello. No, I am not. The recipients here in Braunschweig, Lower Saxony, Northern Germany, are church communities, local soup kitchens for the poor, a kindergarten, the crime victims aid group, a handicapped boy, poor children, and so on and so on. But unfortunately, not me and not my colleagues in at the desk here in the Braunschweiger Zeitung.
Okay, well, maybe you'll get yours in time. Do people really not know any? Do people really have no idea who this person might be?
We don't know who the donor is. He is an anonymous do-gooder. He's handing out, he's giving out secretly, as you said it, envelopes filled with 500 euro notes for the various good causes we named. And what is our position as the local newspaper? We are still delivering the ideas for the do-gooder, but we don't know.
So you're coming up with suggestions of where he should donate to next?
Yes, we don't know what he will do next. We don't know how money there is to distribute. The last envelope has been received last weekend. The donor gave it to the Brunswick Hospice, and I can inform you the total amount now is 190,000 euros.
Wow. And my understanding is that this sort of thing has happened before elsewhere in Germany.
Can we repeat the question once more? Can we repeat it?
Sorry, Henning. My understanding is that something like this has sort of happened in other parts of Germany, perhaps not on this scale before. Is that right?
It's a good story. It's a unique story. We have a similar case in Görlitz in eastern Germany. Donner has given tens of thousands of euros for the reconstruction of the historic city. And the town mayor and the administration, they know his name, but he is anonymous for the public. But such a chain, donations in a public game with the newspaper, with me and my colleagues, I think it is unique.
It sounds it. And very quickly, just before we go, how do people in the town feel about this? Are they obviously quite surprised, but quite happy that this is happening?
It is the story. All people talk about the story.
I'm not surprised.
And the people are wondering about who is it, who can it be.
We'll tell you what, Henning, I'm afraid we're going to leave it there because we're running out of time. But if you ever find out, we'll get you back on Midori House and we'll chat about that when you can reveal who it is. Okay, I'm afraid we're going to leave it there. Henning Noskert, local editor of Braunschweiger Zeitung, thank you very much. That is it for this Wednesday edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Kate Bilbao, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Andrew Carter. The Monocle Daily is going to be here at 2200 London time. They're going to be asking why Russia has decided to change an iconic brand. That's the AK-47. Ta-ra!